drummers Thomas Merton and Henry Thoreau.
Actually, I'm going to depart from or lead up to the major topic today, because I'd like to talk about something a little bit different at the beginning this morning, to tell you why I think Thomas Merton is becoming an important figure in the 20th century, to share with you a little bit of what I do at the Thomas Merton Studies Center. I was trained basically as a social and cultural historian, and that is my major interest. My major interest in Thomas Merton, in fact, is why he has gradually, in the last decade or so, been turned into what we call a signal figure. Someone who seems to speak for our time, someone who in his own experience seems to synthesize the experience of the 20th century. I've written three quotes on the board from three remarkable scholars who sort of pick up this theme. There are people in every era who become symbols because they feel and personalize the forces of an age more deeply and comprehensively than others. Thomas Merton is such a man. This is from Anthony T. Padovano's The Human Journey. Thomas Merton allowed the 20th century to breathe through him. Paul Wilkes, who was the producer of the documentary. And then Thomas Merton expresses in his life and writings the tensions and complexities, the absurdities and aspirations of our time. He will be viewed by future generations, to borrow Anatole France's line from his eulogy for Emile Zola, as a moment in the conscience of humankind. That is from my introduction to the second volume of the Merton Letters, on which I'm currently working. When I was hired by the Merton Legacy Trust and by Bellarmine College to run the Thomas Merton Studies Center in 1973, Thomas Merton had been dead for 5 years. And at that point in time, a few things were being written on him. In that year was the publication of his last journal, the Asian Journal, which was edited and published posthumously. But at that point in time, I really feel Thomas Merton's interest in him could have lapsed. He need not have continued to be a significant figure. But two things seem to have happened. I will begin, actually, the moment I get back to Louisville, practically, my 13th year of doing this. And in those 13 years, publication on Thomas Merton has zoomed. Interest in him has expanded. There's been an explosion, really. An awful lot being written and work being done. Two things, I think, caused this. First of all, Thomas Merton continues to have commercial viability. And for someone to be in front of us, we have to realize others may have said things just as important. Others may have been just as profound or even more so. But if people don't buy the books and read them, that message doesn't get across. So one thing that has happened to Thomas Merton is that he is still a seller. Literally, every major commercial publisher has had or has a Thomas Merton book out there on the market. And believe me, today, publishers are not interested in publishing what won't sell, with the market the way it is and prices the way they are. So that has been a factor. He's available to us, first of all. As I said, I think on Tuesday, literally every one of his major books is in print at this point in time, which is an amazing record for any 20th century author. The second factor, which has helped to turn Thomas Merton into a signal figure, and those of you who come from academia will understand this. Thomas Merton has, in the last 13 years, become an academic industry. That is a term that we use in academia to mean someone who is constantly being worked on. There are a lot of these industries. The Joyce industry, it's usually referred to that way, the Faulkner industry, the Flannery O'Connor industry, where people are constantly writing, hashing and rehashing, in some cases, what these people have written and what they may mean for our times. I first became acquainted with this kind of term when I was a student at Yale, and I was assigned as a bursary student. That's what we were called. They didn't call it work study at Yale then. In my first year, to the Walpole factory. And I thought, naive little boy coming from Indiana, the Walpole factory, why do they call it that? And this was the Yale edition of the correspondence of Horace Walpole, which the project had started in the 1920s. We were by then in the 1960s, and it was still ongoing. And this collection, this project, was referred to as a factory. They also had the Franklin factory at Yale, where they were working on the papers and letters of Benjamin Franklin. And this project, of course, had also been going on for decades. So that when we use this term factory or industry in relation to something academic, we're talking about the fact that people are consistently doing scholarly work on a person. For whatever reason, in the mid-70s, Thomas Merton became an acceptable subject for graduate study. Any of you who have done graduate study know sometimes you really have to make a case to a major professor that what you're going to do is significant, and that it will contribute to the over and all knowledge of humankind. Well, Thomas Merton achieved that status, that academic respectability, very quickly. And I'm talking now not about just Catholic institutions. Because of the over 100 theses that we have on file at the Thomas Merton Study Center now, they have come from what we think of as the big Catholic institutions, Notre Dame, Fordham, the Catholic Theological Union at Berkeley. But we also have theses from Harvard, Princeton, the University of Chicago, the University of Wisconsin, and a number from foreign institutions as well. Okay, when I first was hired, I thought, this is going to be a really easy job. There's not going to be that much to do. What I do for the Thomas Merton Legacy Trust, is a body of three lay people who control all publication and access to the literary estate. As people write and want to publish, that means sooner or later they have to come to me. Because if you're going to do any kind of viable research on Thomas Merton today, you're going to have to work in that literary estate in some way. There have been some things of significance that have been written using only published materials. But particularly for a thesis, professors like for you to do work in some kind of primary sources. So there's a constant stream of people coming through the Thomas Merton Study Center doing work on various aspects of Merton. Also, when articles appear, people want visuals. That's become a big part of my job because Thomas Merton drew so many drawings and took so many photographs. And if you've had any experience with publishers, you'll know that they may drag their feet, but they want you to do it yesterday. And just before I left to come to Holden Village, I got an emergency call from the New York Times, who is running a review of the Merton letters. It may even have appeared now. I haven't seen a newspaper for almost 2 weeks. And they were getting ready to run their review of the first volume of the Merton letters, and they wanted 4 photographs, and they should have called me the week before, because that was when the deadline was, but could I quickly get these photographs out to them? An additional problem is, with over 3,000 photographs, you always have to ask, what did you have in mind? And usually they say, well, what would you suggest? And I usually then say, all right, I'll just send you 4 photographs of my choosing. Sometimes they'll say, well, does he have anything of a tree? We'd like to have something with a tree in it. And yes, he does. He has hundreds with trees in it. So that has become an important aspect of the job. And publishers, I've been getting more and more letters from publishers saying, is there anything on Merton or by Merton that is available to be published? As more and more of the publishers seem to be getting on the Merton bandwagon. So I'm going through all this so that you'll have some idea of how I spend my day. I do spend most of my day answering letters and inquiries from people. And this interest is coming from all over. I was telling the girl who played the flute last night at Vespers that I've just recently been corresponding with someone in Australia who wants to put together an anthology of Merton's writings taken from a number of sources, because he says it's hard to get Merton books in Australia. And also, just before I came to Holden Village, I actually left Louisville on Thursday morning. Yes. Well, Monday and Tuesday, I entertained at the Merton Center 2 professors from the University of Peking who were in this country to attend a conference and who had written through a mutual friend, a Chinese man who left China when Mao Zedong came to power and now teaches in Pennsylvania. And they were going to be traveling with this man because they wanted to visit the Merton Center and they wanted to visit the Abbey of Gethsemane. So even there, where we might least expect interest and knowledge to crop up, it did. The one man is senior professor of philosophy and religion at the University of Peking, which is the oldest collegiate university in China. And the other one, it turned out, was a very powerful individual because he's editor-in-chief of the philosophical section of the People's Press of China, which means he controls any publication which has anything to do with philosophy or religion. And this was a very interesting session, actually, although we had to speak through an interpreter, which sort of meant that everything was doubled in time because I or they would have to say what they had to say, and then it would have to be interpreted back. By the way, one of the interesting things that they said is that the Dalai Lama has been invited to return to China. And we saw in the documentary that the Chinese government at this point in time is very interested in having him return. as a symbol for the Tibetan people. However, they've hit a snag because the communist government is insisting that the Dalai Lama live in Peking. And he wants to live in Lhasa near his people. However, I guess they feel that they want to keep tabs on him, a little more control over him than they might have if he were back in Lhasa. Okay, so carefully, I think, and methodically, in the last 13 years, Thomas Merton has been turned into a signal figure. Where things really began to explode was in 1978, when the first large gathering of what we might call Merton scholars, people who had already written on Merton, was held to commemorate the 10th anniversary of his death. And it was held at the University of British Columbia in Vancouver. And those of us in Merton studies now always refer to the Vancouver Symposium as the kind of watershed of Merton studies, because coming on the heels of this symposium, what it seemed to do was to give a cohesion and a direction to Merton studies. There were about 30 scholarly papers given at that symposium, most of which have now been published. And it allowed all these people then to come together and to share some ideas. Before this time, people really were sort of working at different places in isolation. And since then, there has been an attempt to sort of have symposiums or meetings of groups of people periodically, so that people can continue to sort of share those ideas. I gave an address at that symposium, and it was titled News of the Merton Industry, aping a title of Merton's himself. He did write an article called News of the Joyce Industry. So at this point in time, I would say one of the things that has been a feature of the scholarship is the comparison and contrasting of Merton with other figures. And we now have theses or essays comparing Merton with almost anyone you could imagine in the 20th century. Merton and Karl Barth. That was a natural, since Thomas Merton and Karl Barth both died on December 10th, 1968, and all papers carried obituaries for both of them. They were both featured on the front page of the New York Times on December 11th, obituaries of both. Merton and Jacques Maritain, Merton and Flannery O'Connor, Merton and Sigmund Freud, Merton and C.S. Lewis, Merton and Faulkner, Merton and Karl Rahner. The list goes on and on of these comparisons and contrasting, and I think this is important when we're beginning to see a signal figure created. I guess what I'm trying to say here is, again, let me sort of emphasize this. I don't think it had to happen to Merton, but it has. And every period, as Anthony Padovano points out, does pick up some figures who come to speak for that figure. And Merton is now a prime candidate to speak for our time. Whether this will, in fact, finally happen, it's hard to say. We can't really know at this point in time. But he sure is out there in the front ranks, and is definitely in the running at this point in time. We tend to look back and to personify periods in history by major figures anyway. Those of you who are familiar with the Will and Ariel Durant story of civilization realize that they call two different periods the Age of Voltaire and the Age of Rousseau, which doesn't mean these men were the only people working and thinking in their times, or that they were so far ahead of anybody else in importance. But something about them has come to us to speak of those times. It's also true, I think, that Thomas Merton's own life is a fascinating one. and that it continues to fascinate people. For the last 3 years, we have given an elder hostel program at the Thomas Merton Study Center. If you're familiar with the National Elder Hostel Program for senior citizens, you have to be over 60 or your participating spouse or companion must be over 60. And we call it A Week with Thomas Merton. It has booked almost instantly on registration all 3 years with a waiting list. And some of these senior citizens who come could talk endlessly about Thomas Merton's life. So there is something fascinating there about it. By the way, I want to tell one little anecdote that really has nothing to do with Thomas Merton. But as I said, to participate in the elder hostel, you have to be 60 or your spouse or companion must be. And so I was sort of standing around at registration this year, and this couple came in, and I thought, well, she must be right about 60. And then I looked at him, and I thought, my goodness, he's remarkably well preserved. So later we had a little orientation session, and where people introduced themselves, and the first things out of her mouth when we came to her was, she said, I married a younger man, and I love it. So I had registration forms, and I never really look at people's age on it, so I ran downstairs at my earliest opportunity to look, and she was 62 and he was 44. And it's no wonder he looked remarkably well preserved. Too. We have had instances where men had wives who were not yet 60, but that was our first one where, and a pretty wide range there. Anyway, I was talking about how lives fascinate us and continue to fascinate us. I think we see this with people like Emily Dickinson, who actually didn't have what we might call a very exciting life, since she really never left Amherst. And yet there's something about Emily Dickinson that continues to fascinate us. We like to read about her. And actually, of the one-man shows that have been produced, my personal favorite is The Belle of Amherst, about Emily Dickinson. Lincoln is a figure who, by his very life, continues to interest us, intrigue us, and fascinate us. You know, endless books have been written about Lincoln, and yet there always seems to be something new that we didn't know before, something about the life maybe even that we don't mind reading again. I read Gore Vidal's Lincoln and found it just as interesting, although I thought I already knew everything that could be known about Abraham Lincoln. It continued to add something to my knowledge because I was interested in that person, and I think that this is happening with Thomas Merton. Many have already commented, Robert Lowell did as early as 1948, said that the man seems more interesting than his writings. And although I don't think we can ever divorce Thomas Merton from his writings, there is something about that life experience which holds our attention. Well, I'd like to share with you this morning a piece of Merton scholarship. One of the things that I do, in 1976, we began publishing a little newsletter, just kind of saying what was going on, giving information about forthcoming publications. And we called it the Merton Seasonal of Bellarmine College. Well, in the 10 years since we started publishing that, and I edited it, it has grown till it's now a 24-page little booklet, and now there's pressure from certain quarters, both at the college and the Abbey and by the Merton Trust, for me to start editing a full-scale scholarly journal dealing with Merton. I happen to have a couple of drawers full of unpublished things on Merton. so that we could probably run for quite a few years with such a scholarly journal with the backlog of things that we happen to have. We did start including reviews of books a few years ago and little short articles that people wrote. In the fall of 1984, we carried an article by a Cistercian monk at Conyers in Georgia called Mind Guards Against the White Knight, Thomas Merton and Bob Dylan, which on the surface seems like unlikely bedfellows. And sometime after the publication of this, by the way, goes out to about 2,500 people at this point in time, and we still produce it free of charge. I don't know how we're doing that, but the president of the institution says, no, we won't charge, and you don't question the president. I have a feeling one of these days he'll be saying, why haven't you been charging? And my only answer will be, because you didn't tell me to. But anyway, sometime after that fall issue came out, I got a letter from a French-Canadian who teaches in Montreal, saying that he had been inspired by the article on Thomas Merton and Bob Dylan to write a short piece on Thomas Merton and Henry Thoreau. Well, I couldn't quite see the connection immediately. I think it may have been just the idea of comparing Merton to another figure that did this, because I still have trouble thinking of Bob Dylan and Henry Thoreau quite together. But in any case, I thought it was one of the best things that I had read on Merton, and believe me, I've read a lot of bilge that has been put out. So, just as an example of the kind of thing that is going on in Merton scholarship, I would like to share this little short article with you this morning, and then have a discussion, if we can, about Thomas Merton and his idea of nature and Thoreau. This was written by a man named Gilles Farset, and he does like to be sure that the accent is there. This is called Different Drummers, Thomas Merton and Henry Thoreau. Thoreau's idleness was an incomparable gift, and its fruits were blessings that America has never really learned to appreciate, observed Merton in Conjectures of a Guilty Bystander. Fervent readers of both Henry Thoreau and Thomas Merton will necessarily notice that these writers have a lot in common, so much so that in a way, Merton might be viewed as Thoreau's spokesman in the 20th century, reasserting in a contemporary context all the values for which the author of Walden had stood. The deep similarities between Thoreau and Merton deserve to be treated in a detailed comparative study. Meanwhile, this short article will only attempt to point out some of the more obvious and important parallels. First of all, it must be said that both men were highly original individuals who always paid attention to the beat of a different drummer, thus exposing themselves to criticism and misunderstanding. In fact, almost all mystics have experienced at some point that by trying to advance in the direction of their dreams, they were profoundly disturbing people who had settled down somewhere at the beginning of the road and did not intend to go any further. Thoreau often passed for a misanthrope and an egotist, and was suspiciously regarded by his neighbors. Merton increasingly became a freelance monk, in the words of his friend Edward Rice, fighting against the censors and shocking many Catholics who did not want to hear about Zen, peace, or nuclear weapons. Both men were educated persons who took issue with society at an early age and somehow rejected the way of life they were expected to adopt. Merton by becoming a Trappist monk and eventually a hermit, Thoreau by spending most of his time in the woods, refusing to be tied down to any job in order to devote himself to what he called his profession, namely, to be always on the alert to find God in nature. Although they really loved to talk and share experience with others, both men were basically loners who chose solitude as their lifelong and dearest companion. In Walden, Thoreau explains, "I went to the woods because I wished to live deliberately, to front only the essential facts of life, and see if I could not learn what it had to teach, and not, when I came to die, discover that I had not lived." Probably recognizing the reasons, or at least some of the reasons, which led him to the monastery, Merton copied this passage in the journal subsequently published as The Sign of Jonas. At the end of his life, he got his own hermitage in the woods, and even had his own Walden pond, appropriately dubbed Monk's Pond. And of course, Thoreau and Merton were writers. They could not help it, and therefore strove to communicate the best that was in them and make it a work of art. It is interesting to note that they mostly express themselves through the same genre, that is to say, spiritual autobiography, undoubtedly because it was the most congenial mode for what they had to say. Quote, "I require of every writer, first or last, a simple and sincere account of his own life," unquote, wrote Thoreau at the beginning of Walden. He stuck to this requirement. And on the whole, so did Merton, whose Seven Story Mountain is just what the author of Walden demanded. Just as the best of Thoreau's writing is to be found in his journals, many of Merton's best works, such as The Sign of Jonas, Conjectures of a Guilty Bystander, The Asian Journal, are journals or reflections taken from his notebooks. Even the articles and essays Thoreau wrote, the most famous being Civil Disobedience, sprang directly from his own experience and can be considered as another form of spiritual autobiography. They are not intellectual performances or demonstrations, but intuitive insights and observations recorded by a writer who works with his soul and draws on the richness of his inner life. The same can be said about Merton's essays. His books on Zen and Eastern mysticism, for example, not only penetrate the essence of these teachings, but precisely do so because they tell at the same time the story of the author's own pilgrimage, explaining the ways in which he himself relates to this wisdom. As Anthony Padovano has pointed out, Merton's predilection for spiritual autobiography places him at the core of the American literary tradition, which from the early Puritan journals to the novels of Jack Kerouac, has always been fascinated by the self in quest of an identity. In the footsteps of Thoreau, Merton spent his life recording his inner journey as he went along. The woods of his birthplace, Concord, were Thoreau's church, where he naturally practiced contemplation. Although Merton originally was a city man, and could not claim Thoreau's exceptional familiarity with nature, he nevertheless often discovered the presence of God in the woods. Part three of Conjectures is introduced by a beautiful passage which is very close to Thoreau's pages on morning and wakefulness. Both writers love dawn, which is the privileged moment when they catch a glimpse of what T.S. Eliot calls the still point of the turning world. This virgin point, Merton, or meeting of two eternities, Thoreau, gives them a sense of witnessing the very first morning, of being present at the creation of the world. In this vigorous joy of nature awakening to itself, Thoreau and Merton see a tremendous opportunity for redemption. As Merton puts it, "Paradise is all around us, and we do not understand. It is wide open. The sword is taken away, but we do not know it." Thoreau observes that, in a pleasant spring morning, all men's sins are forgiven. But both writers know that men are too busy to pay attention to this daily miracle and seize this opportunity to plunge back into Eden. In Thoreau's words, they do not obey the hint which God gives them, nor accept the pardon which he freely offers all. As Merton puts it, wisdom, cries the dawn deacon, but we do not attend. If Thoreau and Merton were men of solitude and contemplation, they nevertheless took strong positions on some of the most disputed social and political questions of their time. The strength of their appeals probably comes from the purity of their motives, and may also be due to the fact that they viewed the world from a distance. Originating in silence, rather than in the whirlpool of public opinion and debate, their reflections always strike at the root of the matter involved. The causes they fought for, before being political, were above all moral issues. They did not commit themselves to serve any party or ideology. In fact, Merton's writings on peace really challenged certain forms of Catholic ideology. But both spoke because they felt it was demanded of them to do so, that the law of their being gave them no alternative. Trying to be faithful to one's inmost convictions may often prove quite dangerous. In an informal talk delivered at Calcutta, Merton said that since the monk is essentially outside of all establishments, he speaks as a representative of all marginal persons who had withdrawn deliberately to the margin of society with a view to deepening fundamental human experience. Indeed, Thoreau and Merton spent a good deal of their lives fighting establishments. Thoreau braved the law by helping runaway slaves to enter Canada. He publicly denounced slavery and pleaded for the abolitionist John Brown, who had been sentenced to death. His night in jail, which prompted him to write the essay entitled Civil Disobedience, has become part of American mythology. As for Merton, he braved the censors who did not want him to write against racism and nuclear weapons, daring to live up to the gospel without ever ceasing to be a contemplative. The link with Thoreau becomes even more obvious if we think of Gandhi's strong influence on Merton. Thoreau's civil disobedience played a great part in shaping the Mahatma's thought and tactics, which opened new vistas for the monk of Gethsemane. Finally, both writers were deeply interested in Eastern mysticism and contributed to popularize it at a time when Orientalism had not become the fashion that it is today. Along with his friend Ralph Waldo Emerson, Thoreau was one of the very first Americans to gain a deep knowledge of Hindu and Chinese scriptures and to make some of it pass into his daily life. He had found an enlivening spiritual influence in the Eastern mystics, who insisted on experiencing the divine rather than talking about it, on joy and contemplation rather than on punishment and deeds. Hinduism and Buddhism challenged the self-satisfied religion practiced by many of his fellow Christians. In the same way, Merton felt that Eastern mysticism, Zen in particular, could revive Christianity and lead it away from sterile rationalizations, back to its ascetic roots as preached and practiced by the Desert Fathers. This interest in other religions and cultures was a manifestation of Thoreau's and Merton's prophetic openness. Both were above all intuitive geniuses who had the ability to transcend the limitations which any background must necessarily have in order to commune at the summit of universal religious experience. Quote, I have no sympathy with the bigotry and ignorance which make transient and partial and puerile distinctions between one man's faith or form of faith and another's, as Christian and heathen. I like Brahma, Hari, Buddha, the Great Spirit, as well as God, noted Thoreau. As for Merton, without ever ceasing to be a Catholic, he expressed his conviction the Christian should not overlook Eastern religions, but on the contrary, be prepared to learn from them. Quote, I think we have now reached a stage of long overdue religious maturity, at which it may be possible for someone to remain perfectly faithful to a Christian and Western monastic commitment, and yet to learn in depth from, say, a Buddhist or Hindu discipline and experience. I believe that some of us need to do this in order to improve the quality of our own monastic life, and even to help in the task of monastic renewal, which has been undertaken within the Western Church. Thoreau's and Merton's openness was a manifestation not only of intelligence, but of love, of spiritual nonviolence, made possible by a lifelong commitment to truth. Thoreau had clearly seen that most men are living lives of quiet desperation as a result of being in a false position, unfaithful to their own true self. And Gandhi, who said that lying is the mother of violence, taught Merton that quiet desperation, born of untruthfulness, is likely to turn quickly into violent hatred. As Merton noted in his journal, meditating on Gandhi's words, the lie brings violence and disorder into our nature itself. It divides us against ourselves, alienates us from ourselves, makes us enemies of ourselves and of the truth that is in us. From this division, hatred and violence arise. We hate others because we cannot stand the disorder, the intolerable division in ourselves. We are violent to others because we are already divided by the inner violence of our infidelity to our own truth. Hatred projects this division outside ourselves into society. The tremendous and very special appeal both writers have had on countless readers may be explained by the complete authenticity one can sense in their words. They not only express something essential, but also do it from their own experience, giving their readers that unmistakable taste of truth, which has become so rare at a time when people tend to write, not because they really have anything to say, but because they think it is important for something by them to be in print, as Merton himself observed. Quote, how many a man has dated a new era in his life from the reading of a book, exclaimed Thoreau. And indeed, innumerable readers of Thoreau and Merton report that the discovery of either author marked a turning point in their life and often changed it in a very practical way. Both men endeavored to be what they were made, to use Thoreau's expression, and their writings still contribute to our happiness by helping us to become what we are. Okay, I'd like to open it up now for discussion. I've talked long enough for any comments you might have to make. Yes?
I'd like to ask a question. If you were to compare Merton to someone in the 20th century, what person or persons might you choose?
A 20th century figure. That's a toughie.
I was just wondering who out there might have been a seminal thinker in the same way, who has not received the kind of publicity, not necessarily publicity, but growing following that Merton has experienced, who we should be thinking about, knowing about, in a sense, ourselves.
I can't think of one. I can think of some who have fallen by the wayside who were once very widely read.
Like?
Bishop Sheen. If you remember, he had a TV program. His books were all smash bestsellers. No one reads or seems to read Bishop Sheen any longer.
In fact, I imagine if you asked some of the young people at Holden who he is, they wouldn't know. Of course, they didn't know who Thomas Merton was. But that's beside the point.
But one other question, that has to do with how much influence do you think his thinking in regard to war has had on the American bishops, peace pastoral, and just their thinking in general?
The pastoral in 1983 reads like a gloss on Thomas Merton. That's how much influence he has had. He'd only been dead for, 17 years when they finally got around to that.
Well, you know, we have to be so grateful that they did.
Yes. Yes.
What's Merton did a lot of reading, and that was one of his forms of community, the ways in which ideas worked for him and developed. I'm finding that, for instance, just to follow that up on the Catholic bishops and their struggle with the definitions of ways of perceiving peacemaking, relinquishing the just war theory and moving toward a firmer category, but that movement was one that seemed to occur among a number of people that was going on. Was that more through reading, through conversation, was that a personal journey that was in more in isolation? How did you see
Merton get to that point?
Yeah.
From within himself, first of all, I think, but then he read voraciously. And in many ways, Merton wasn't a very original thinker. He was a synthesizer. He picked up the strands, primarily from his reading. Sometimes from conversation, but despite the fact that I say he had visitors at Gethsemane, you know, he wasn't having conversations every day, even the way we would. And he pulled these strands, I think, together in his own writings, from his reading.
I discovered for myself, and maybe I just think that way, and there are other people that think differently, but I find ideas or development of feelings and concepts to be a corporate activity rather than I'm not sure what an original thinker is, as opposed to a synthesizer is.
Well, very probably I would agree with you that a lot of people come to the same point at the same time. What makes somebody like Merton important, perhaps, is that he happened to get there before some of the rest of us did, including the Catholic bishops.
I'm just struggling with how that happens for someone who is a Trappist, and how that occurred for them.
I think Merton, again, and I think Gilles Farset points this out about Merton and Thoreau, that sometimes perhaps we can observe more dispassionately and objectively when we're not in the middle of things. By withdrawing. And also, Merton had fewer hidden agendas. He wasn't worried about losing a job because of what he wrote or said. At the point in time he was doing this, they may not have been happy with him, even at the Abbey, his abbot. But what was he going to do? If he kicked him out, goodness, he would never have kicked Merton out. The Catholic Church could not have done that. The furor would have brought much more attention than it deserved. Yeah. Does that speak to what you're talking about? Let me just say one other thing on this. I think a lot of it came from within, because many of Merton's later essays are, in fact, or started out, in fact, as book reviews. But you pick up some because Merton took the book as sort of a catalyst to spring off into his own thoughts. So you pick some of these up, thinking it may be a book review, and you think, when is he going to talk about the book? Because he took the occasion to go off on a tangent, which the book caused him to do. And because he could see connections between so many divergent things and tie them together. Yes?
What are some of the universal aspects of the various religions that he was most interested in, that he focused on?
I think the idea of creation as a unity, as a wholeness, which he, and I think Thoreau too, both thought Christians had gotten away from. You know, we in the West like to pigeonhole, we like to compartmentalize. We like to put people and things into their own categories. And in fact, Western science has to a great extent been based on categorizing everything. And everything must fit into its own category. I think they saw less of that going on with the Eastern religions and Eastern thought. In fact, much more resistant to that categorizing. I was saying to Herman, he came in earlier and he said, do you think Merton was rather pantheistic? And in many ways, I think he was. Because particularly, I think, he was influenced by Japanese thought, where they see divinity, if you want to call it that, because the Japanese don't really have a word for an omnipotent, omniscient being. The closest you can get is their word kami, K-A-M-I, which most of you may know in connection with kamikaze, which we translate as wind of the gods. But to them, everything has come, living or dead, animate or inanimate. And very often what they are doing in their tea ceremony, in their flower arrangement, is allowing the kami that is in everything to come through.
I get the impression that in the last years of his life that he was moving perhaps in the direction of a more of a unity of religions. Is that an error?
No, it's not. I think, as far as worship was concerned, the Roman Catholic liturgy did something for Merton that nothing else did. Or at least he tells us that. But I think he wanted, if not complete unity, certainly more understanding. Because I think he came to feel that there is probably more than one way to reach God. And that his way, which worked for him, might not work for someone else. Yeah.
I was just wondering if he had taken a look in that connection at Mohammedanism, and is there any writing at all about it?
Not much writing, but he gave a whole series of talks to the novices. I think they should be transcribed and published. But the problem, as you know, sometimes with lectures is when they're written down, they don't read too well. So it would take some editing, particularly on Sufism, Islamic mysticism. And he became very interested in that. And in fact wrote to one man, Abdul Aziz, A-Z-I-Z, in Karachi, that his form, Merton's form of meditation, was quite similar to that of the Sufis, in which he sat down and did not try in his meditation to think of or imagine anything, but to let the spirit, the divinity, whatever you call it, fill him, so that it was not an action of his, but an action of the spirit. So definitely a kind of trying to empty yourself, so that you are receptive then. Which I think, you know, Christians think we need to be doing something. We in the West always think we need to be doing something, to actually be saying words in prayer, or to be actively thinking of something. Whereas in the East, they feel that you get there when you do the least. There's an old Taoist proverb that says, once you try Tao, T-A-O, meaning the way, that once you try to explain the Tao, you've already missed it. And I think that that whole thing of that kind of non-action, non-verbalizing, appealed to Merton, even though he turned out millions and millions of words on his typewriter. Yes?
You're typically finding a contemporary figure to compare him with. Wouldn't Martin Luther King perhaps be a figure that would be worthy of some kind of comparison or parallels?
Yes, and no one has actually done that yet. That could be a good one, although I don't think, I think there are differences.
But what are some of the...
King was out there actively. Mm-hmm. And that's a major difference, because Merton steadily refused to be an activist in that sense. Excuse me.
No, I was just going to ask the question of the similarities and differences, the activism and the method are, I suppose, the most obvious, but how was their thought in there?
I think they're very close in their ideas on nonviolence. And both owe a tremendous debt, I think, to Gandhi, who's another signal figure of our time. Despite that dull, turgid film. I'm sorry, maybe some of you really liked it. But I found it rather slow and ponderous. Yeah, did cover a lot of time. I think King and Merton were alike, too, in seeing the fundamental problem, the black problem, in a similar way. Because I both think they felt it was not so much the black man's problem as the white man's. And Merton spent a lot of space writing about that.
Just thinking of the similarity of how people within their each of their own movements and thought, while agreeing with him, would like to contain them within that. There were those that would want to keep Merton within a certain Catholicism and moving out into all these other things like peacemaking and nuclear war. And King, there's a lot of civil rights people that were trying to convince him stick with civil rights and aren't talking about peace. And
just get seats at the counter and on the bus and don't do anything.
Yeah, right. So there's that pressure that one gets from one's friends is sometimes more disastrous than enemies.
But neither would do that.
And neither would give into it. Right. And there's that